Hi, I'm David Mickey Evans, probably best known as the writer, director, and voice of The Sandlot. And I'm the next guest on Screen and Beyond.
On Screen and Beyond, an inside look into the entertainment world featuring interviews with people from the movie, TV, and music industry, news on upcoming TV and DVD releases, and the rumor mill. And now, here's the host of On Screen and Beyond, Brian Zemrak.
Hey, welcome back to On Screen and Beyond. And if you're here for the first time, I hope you're going to enjoy our show. We have a lot of great guests here. Go back to onscreenandbeyond.com and listen to all our episodes. I'm sure you're going to find some great people that you really enjoyed watching and listening to over the years at onscreenandbeyond.com. I'm your host, Brian Zemrak, and this is On Screen and Beyond, the weekly show that keeps you updated on what's coming your way as far as upcoming new movies, remakes, sequels, and TV and movie DVD releases, as well as our interview segment with a guest from the movie, TV, or music industry. This is episode 335 of On Screen and Beyond, and David Mickey Evans is going to be joining us this week. He is a writer, director. He gave us Radio Flyer and a great movie, The Sandlot. That's right. And he was the voice, the guy who narrated it all through there. So we got a lot of things to talk about with Mickey. He's got some new projects that are going on, and hopefully we'll get some inside information from him. All right. So that's coming up in a few minutes right here. David Mickey Evans right here on Screen and Beyond from The Sandlot. And if you are on Facebook, I hope you're going to like us. And if you tell a friend, we like that because we get more listeners here at On Screen and Beyond. And like I said earlier, if you go to onscreenandbeyond.com, you'll see all 335 episodes of this show. And we have so many different people on there from the music world and, of course, from movies and TV. So check it out. And if you have a suggestion, be sure to send it to us at feedback@onscreenandbeyond.com. I will see what I can do about getting that person on. And it's a little difficult sometimes. First, we have to try to find a connection. And once we can get the connection, then we got to convince them that, this is a show that they could enjoy being on. So if we've done an interview with a friend or somebody they've worked with, it more likely we'll get them on here. So if you have a connection, then let me know, because I'd love to get somebody that you know, too. Send your suggestions to feedback@onscreenandbeyond.com. We'll see about getting it on. All right, what do you say? We got a lot of strange things coming your way in remakes and upcoming new movies, and also in sequels, of course. Let's get right into it. It's time for Remake Madness right here on Screen and Beyond.
Please hang up and try again.
Remake Madness. Well, the remake of Disney's Pete's Dragon is moving along, and word is out that Robert Redford will play a major role in it. Now, I don't know if he's going to play like the role that Mickey Rooney played in the original, but we'll find out as soon as we hear more. And another classic TV show is headed for the big screen as far into a remake. Looks like Little House on the Prairie is in the works. So that could be interesting. And Vince Vaughn, we've talked about this before, but just hinted on it, that he is remaking the TV show The Rockford Files, putting it up on the silver screen. So that's what we got coming your way. And next on Screen and Beyond, it is time for upcoming new movies. Upcoming new movies, Will Smith will star in The American Can. It's based on a true story of a ex-Marine who rescues 244 people from his apartment building after Hurricane Katrina. And you can look for Patrick Warburton, James Caan, Nathan Lane, and Brian Dennehy to star in Sweetwater. It's coming out in 2015, and it's a story about the first African-American to play in the NBA back in 1950. And Nicole Kidman and Jason Bateman will star in The Family Fang, as a brother and sister return home to find their famous parents who have disappeared. That's it for upcoming new movies. Next on Screen and Beyond, taking you down to Sequel City to find out what's coming your way as far as sequels. Sequel City, it looks like Pacific Rim 3 is moving along. According to Guillermo del Toro, he will write and direct the third installment, and the second one hasn't even come out, but he's already talking about Pacific Rim 3. And between now and 2020, Warner Brothers and DC Comics plans to release 12 movies, including Justice League, 1 and 2, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, Shazam, The Suicide Squad, and more solo Batman and Superman sequels. So that's a lot of stuff coming our way as far as superheroes. And Bridget Jones 3 is still being bounced around, but Hugh Grant says, he definitely will not be involved. We'll find out if that holds true. That's it for Sequel City. Coming up next on Screen and Beyond, what's coming your way as far as TV on DVD?
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
TV on DVD, December 9th, Family Guy, Volume 13 will land in a 3-disc set on DVD, and October 28th, In Search of Ancient Mysteries. Now, this was narrated by Rod Serling, and it arrives, and this is really the beginnings of what led into the In Search of show that was hosted by Leonard Nimoy. And it's also actually sort of very similar in a lead for the Ancient Aliens series that's on now, I guess. And on December 11th, The Americans, the complete second season, lands on DVD. That's it for TV on DVD. Next on Screen and Beyond, Movies on DVD. Movies on DVD, October 21st, Film Chest releases A Woman in Flames. Now, that's a 1983 drama. And on January 6th, Boyhood with Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette will hit stores. And The Expendables 3 arrives on DVD and Blu-ray on November 25th. That is it for Movies on DVD. Coming up next on Screen and Beyond, it is TV and Entertainment Time. TV and Entertainment Time. Well, Neil Patrick Harris, of course, everybody knows now, will be the host of this year's Oscars. And a new version. Now, this is a TV remake of The Courtship of Eddie's Father is in the works over at Fox. If you remember that show from the 60s, and it was a Bill Bixby in it, and it was a Brandon Cruz. So we'll see what they do with that. And also another remaking or retelling or continuation, actually, the continuation of Twin Peaks is heading our way. We'll keep you informed on that. That's it for TV time. And next on Screen and Beyond, it's Celebrity Birthday Time. Celebrity birthday time, October 19th, John Lithgow turns 68, John Favreau turns 47, and October 21st, Carrie Fisher, that's right, from Star Wars, turns 57, and October 22nd, Christopher Lloyd turns 75, Jeff Goldblum turns 61, and on October 23rd, Ryan Reynolds turns 37, and Weird Al Yankovic turns 54 years old, and October 24th, Kevin Kline turns 66. That's it for celebrity birthdays. Listeners' birthdays, if you would like to have your birthday said here on Screen and Beyond so the whole world knows about it, whether it's yours, a friend's, a relative, whatever, send it to me at feedback@onscreenandbeyond.com. Include all the information, when it is, and also how old they are if you want, and their name. A lot of people just want me to say their first name and their first initial or last initial, rather, or whatever. Whatever you're comfortable with, send it to me at feedback@onscreenandbeyond, and we'll get it on. Just like these, October 17th, it looks like a Crystal J in Cincinnati, Ohio, turns 47. And on October 21st, David R. in Hamburg, Germany, turns 38 years old. And that's it for birthdays here at On Screen and Beyond. Wish everybody happy birthday. And once again, send us your information. We'll get yours on right here at On Screen and Beyond. And now it's time for our celebrity interview. We have David Mickey Evans, the writer, director, producer of The Sandlot and Radio Flyer, right here at On Screen and Beyond. David is up next. Today on Screen and Beyond, my guest is a writer, producer, and director who gave us such films as Radio Flyer, First Kid, and of course, The Sandlot. It's David Mickey Evans. David, welcome to On Screen and Beyond.
Hey, Brian, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it very much.
David, I got to tell you, one of my favorite movies is The Sandlot. It's just one of those movies that, you know, everybody just seems to love.
Well, me too. I understand. I understood sort of the first, 18 years that that movie had been around, and then it really came home to me last year, the year of 2013. That was the 20th anniversary of the film, and 20th Century Fox sent me on tour all over the United States for, 8 or 9 months. We did probably about 33,000 miles, maybe 25 major and minor league ballparks where we would show the film, in baseball stadiums, and had no idea what was going to happen or even if anybody was going to show up. And by the end of it, after I had met literally hundreds of thousands of fans and signed tens of thousands of autographs and heard firsthand from moms and dads and kids and even little kids down to 3 years old to grandfathers and grandmothers who told me that it wasn't just that they loved the film. Many, many times they would say, I love this. This was awesome. They'd say, Mr. Evans, just don't understand. Good question. I would say, well, what is it that I don't understand? And invariably they would say, you see, this movie and those kids in that movie are like part of our lives. They're part of our family.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, they're like my kids or our kids' siblings, who sort of taught them lessons and entertained them growing up. So, yeah, there's a pretty large, pervasive love for that film. I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah. Now, when you were a kid, did that reflect a lot of the things that you went through when you were growing up? Did you play in a sand lot and things like that?
Well, a lot of it was what I wished my childhood had been like.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it was my childhood. I didn't have a really cool sandlot like that, and I was a kid in the 70s rather than the early 60s. But nonetheless, yeah, we out on the street that we lived out on the asphalt, we would play the baseball during baseball season, basketball during basketball season, that sort of thing. And there was an incident in my childhood when my little brother, without me, went down to the end of the block where some kids that lived on the block when we were kids, they didn't like us very much. In fact, they hated us for various reasons. It was not good. And they had hit a ball over a backyard fence and told my little brother, if you want to play, you go get the ball and you can play with us. Because in those days, when you had a baseball, you had a baseball, not like today when you have a bag of baseball.
Right.
So if you, you shanked it into a yard, you had to go get it. So anyway, he went and got it in that backyard, lived a very vicious dog, believe it or not, named Hercules. And he got the ball, but the dog got him and bit his leg up really bad. So,
ooh.
Yeah, it was sort of a, thinking about that, what I essentially did, it was this sort of cathartic writer's thing where, rather than trying to hunt those guys down in my adult life, make them pay, I decided just to turn them all into heroes, forgive them, and move on. And, the result of that is The Sandlot. So it seems to have worked out pretty good, that whole forgiveness thing.
Right, yeah. You got the better part of that deal.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
So what did you do as far as... writing that. Well, let's start with Radio Flyer. Now, that was your first. Was that your first writing that you had done?
Oh gosh, no! It was my first. It was my first big studio sale for sure. That one broke all the records in Hollywood, and that was about 2.5 years after I had graduated college and lived that complete starving artist life, which was just no fun at all. And I wrote. I didn't know what to do. I had a communication arts degree and 4 college degrees and a load of student debt and all that. I had no idea what to do, and so I decided to write a novel. And I wrote a novel, and I got probably 25 or 26 rejection slips. And then nobody in my gene pool had ever been in the entertainment business, let alone motion pictures. But through a friend and this and that, the other thing, I eventually met a person who was the daughter of a business manager in the entertainment world. And through that person, I met an entertainment lawyer, and I let him read the novel. He called me up the next day in tears and said, you got to turn this into a movie, into a screenplay. So I did. And it took me, I don't know, about a month or so to turn that novel into a screenplay. And a week later, that script broke every record in Hollywood, and that was Radio Flyer.
Wow. Jeez.
Yeah.
Now, is it a big difference writing the novel as compared to writing a screenplay?
I think so, yeah. You know, people don't realize, and, you know, they think, oh, screenplays are easy. You know, they're 90 to 120 pages, blah, blah, blah. And that could not be further from the truth. Of all the forms in which there are to write, the one within which it is most difficult to write well is the screenplay form. And that's for a host of reasons, but none the least of which is because it's what you see and what you hear. And that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
In a novel, you can do anything.
Right.
You can go anywhere in any time. You can be inside someone's head. You can be inside someone's head who was inside someone's head, and, you know, so on and so on and so on. So writing a screenplay, an effective, clean screenplay, is very, very difficult. And it took a lot of effort. You know, there was a lot that had to be left out, and stuff that needed to be necessarily compressed and combined from the novel. And, you know, I thought I did a pretty good job and made the right decisions. And, you know, then the movie got made, and I learned a lot of valuable lessons during that time. And that is that once you type Fade Out, if you don't have a hand in producing it and or direct it, it's going to get changed. And mm-hmm. a lot of those changes, as a writer, you're not going to be too happy with.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I can imagine it. I mean, you know, let's face it, this is your baby. You wrote it. And mm-hmm. I mean, you were fortunate enough to be able to write the screenplay, because I imagine a lot of times the screenplay is really a lot different if somebody else writes it. I mean, that's just a guess, but.
Sure.
And it must be hard for the writers.
Yeah, it is. I think, if you've got a novel or something and you're not involved in the writing of the screenplay or the coming up with that. Yeah, I mean, you're sort of at the mercy of whatever the process is that the writer that's doing that uses. And that process, if it's not akin to yours, and, you know, those feelings, those thoughts, that drama, that conflict, those characters, and all of that is a part of you, any writer worth their soul is in every piece of writing that they do, then yeah, it necessarily comes out different, and that's not always a good thing.
Yeah. Now, compared to Radio Flyer and now the Sandlot, you compare those two, where you had, I take it, you had more control over the Sandlot because you wrote it, you directed it. Did you produce that one too?
Yeah, I had a hand in that.
You had a hand in that?
I had a couple of enormously talented and capable producers on that one, Kathleen Summers and Mark Berg, and they helped me a lot. But yeah, as far as the performances and shooting what I wanted to shoot the way I wanted to shoot it, the way I saw it, yeah, that movie's, if I had to put a percentage on it, it's probably between 85% and 90% of what I meant, which is a remarkable average.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there, you know, you make three movies. You write a movie, you direct a movie, and then you edit a movie. And I'm very, very fortunate that in the end, it ended up being very, very close to what I intended.
Yeah. Did you ever think that it would be still as notable as it is now, 20 years later?
Oh, no. You hope. You know, those are always the hopes, that you make something that stands the test of time, or becomes what they like to refer to as an evergreen film. You know, you think about evergreen films, and with the exception of, let's say, the classic Disney animated stuff from the, you know, 38, probably through the late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And then things like holiday pictures, you know, A Christmas Story, It's a Wonderful Life, things like that.
Right.
Most evergreen films are holiday-oriented films.
Right.
The great majority of them. That's something that the, I mean, it takes place in the summer. There's a little bit of 4th of July in there, but it's certainly not a holiday film. That something like that would become the worldwide, and it really is a phenomenon. I mean, it's not me speaking, but it consistently wins, you know, the Sports Illustrated contest and, you know, Bleacher's Report and all that stuff every year. The best baseball movie ever made and the greatest summer movie of all time. So how that happened, I have no idea. If I had to guess, it was the synergy and the relationship that I had with the young actors in that movie. We really got along, and they really understood what I needed them to do and bring to their individual role. I think Fox did a great job in the initial marketing of the thing. That's a really big part of any film. And, I mean, all in all, I think the movie is very honest. It's authentic. I think it's funny. These people tell me it is. And I think that it has the one thing it engenders in an audience that is most, I think, difficult to achieve is that you identify with those characters.
Oh, yeah.
Either as having been one of those characters when you were a kid,
mm-hmm.
or wanting to have been one of those characters when you were a kid. So I think that's where its longevity lies, you know?
Yeah. Now, you worked with relatively unknown kids, which you always hear that kids working with kids is tough, and you were working with relatively unknowns. Did you find that difficult?
No, actually, I found it wonderful. I got to be a kid, you know.
Right.
There's, you know, you're right. Not a lot of those kids had ever been in front of a movie camera before, and I didn't cast them, you know, so that they could come in and turn in some Laurence Olivier or Dustin Hoffman sort of performance. I cast them just based on themselves, you know,
mm-hmm.
Casting them as the characters just because they had, personalities that just lit up. They were honest kids. They were fearless. They were nice kids, all good kids, quality young guys. And like that, but working with, look, sometimes it's like herding squirrels. I mean, it really is. Because, you know, these guys were 11, 12, and 13 and had, you know, more energy than you can imagine. And, you know, and movie making sometimes was a bit of a slow and boring process.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, keeping them focused was sometimes a chore, but not one that we didn't know that we would have to address. Plus, we shot in the summer. They didn't, you know, they didn't have school. They had some school on set stuff. But for the most part, you know, they only worked 6 or 8 hours a day, and then they could go hang out together and be buddies and have pretty much, and I've heard this from every single one of them, the greatest summer of their lives. I mean, to this day, they tell me that. So
yeah.
it was all cool.
Wow. On the flip side, you had Dennis Leary, Karen Allen, and James Earl Jones on there who are, you know, quite notable people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was kind of funny. I mean, for the first couple of weeks of shooting, I didn't have any adult actors there at all. We were doing just most of the, you know, the kid scenes and all that. So there I was interfacing with 11, 12, and 13-year-olds, sort of communicating with them the way they needed to be communicated with. And, you know, you kind of start being a little kid again, you know, or an adolescent. And then two and a half weeks in, you know, Karen and Dennis show up. And obviously Mr. Jones, and it was remarkable because we would talk about scene, you know, light it, set it up, block it, and then I'd shoot it, and I was so used to saying, okay, that was pretty good, let's do it again, or here's some adjustments, or why don't you try this, or whatever, and then the first time these guys are in a scene and do, I say, action and cut, it's I didn't have anything else to say. they were just, it was done, you know?
Yeah.
So we'd do one or two for safety, and that was it. That's the big difference between, you know, young kid sort actors and polished professionals.
Right.
And that was wonderful and remarkable to see and also to experience.
Yeah. Now, who made the decision that you were going to be the narrator of it? And you did a great job. I thought the voice was great on there.
Well, that was the actor that played the adult Scotty Smalls in the movie is a terrific actor and a wonderful guy named Arliss Howard. And Arliss, if memory serves, is from the South, maybe Alabama, Mississippi, something like that. And in real life, as he's walking around, Arliss has a bit of a drawl, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so this was supposed to be the San Fernando Valley in the early 70s. So, you know, it wasn't as if Scotty Smalls was a kid with a southern draw. So we went in after the movie was cut and all that, and Arliss came in to lay down the narration, and it just sort of didn't work. We came to an agreement about that. I figured I had to figure something else out. So we're sitting there in the recording studio as he goes on his way, and my editor, the great Michael Stevenson, looks at me and goes, "Well, you do it." I said, "Me?" He says, "Yeah, you wrote it. You know how to say it. Go in there and do it." And we did. And I did it probably in two takes, the entire thing.
Wow.
changed some stuff and made some stuff up as we were sitting there that occurred to us. And it's been like that ever since. So it was really cool.
Yeah. I mean, it just fits so well, and it just seems so real. And of course, you wrote it, so of course I would, you know, it would be like that, I guess.
Yeah, I guess, you know. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that never ceases to amaze you is, you know, I've been all over the United States and, you know, various parts of the world, and I have many times been... there was a time I was in Missouri coming back from doing a picture in Iowa, and we stopped in the middle of nowhere and went to a coffee shop to get a coffee, and two of my kids were with me. And so I said, "I'd like to get a black coffee and two hot chocolates with whipped cream." And there was a young lady behind the counter, it's probably 18 or 19. She stares at me as if I'm trying to rob the place, you know? And I said, black coffee and two hot chocolates with whipped cream, are we good? And she's, "Oh my God, you're that guy." And I didn't know if she was talking to me. I looked around, she goes, no, "You're the Sandlot guy." So that was, you know, one of the times that it came, how enormously powerful motion pictures are.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
It's, you know, who am I to that person? And I learned that at least my voice in that movie was important to them. So that was very cool.
Yeah, that's incredible. Jeez. So now you've done a lot of other different things, and I noticed that you are working on a new film called The Treehouse.
The Treehouse is a picture we hope to shoot early next year. A bit of a story about honor, and it's got a bit of an anti-bullying message to it. Like that. A lot of fun as well, a lot of fun, about two groups of rival kids, all in the 12 to 13 year old range, who one summer go to war for possession of a very famous, awesome treehouse. So.
Sounds great.
I didn't write that. Yeah, it's pretty cool. I didn't write it, but I do look very much forward to directing it.
Yeah.
I've got a number of other things on the front burners. One is that I just finished the screenplay for, probably about a month ago. And this one might go before The Treehouse, and it's called The Sacred Acre. And it's actually based on a true story, the story of one of the greatest high school football coaches that ever lived, Ed Thomas from Parkersburg, Iowa. Bit of a tragic story, but an enormously compelling story. So we got that and a bunch of other stuff.
Is that something that you wrote?
Yeah, I did. I wrote that one.
You wrote that one too. Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I've done a number of, pictures that were based on either true stories, or even a bigger responsibility is based on true stories regarding people or the relatives of that still are amongst us. And that is a, it is a very difficult road to go down, because you've got a lot more than just the needs of the story to address.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the concerns of the people.
Yeah.
So far, you know, I seem to bat in the high 900s on that. So it's very difficult. It's always a big challenge, and I always like those challenges.
Yeah, I would think that writing a story that is a true, based on a true story, is tough, because a lot of times, and maybe it's not the writer that does it or the director, it might be the studios, but that movie that's out right now about the game Stands Tall.
Uh-huh.
I've heard that one is, there's things that didn't really happen in real life, and they've changed things, like the football coach's son wasn't actually a football player, but he was in the movie, and, you know, a lot of different things like that. So, you know, you always wonder who makes these decisions, you know?
That is a very good question. And it sort of depends. A lot of that becomes studio-oriented committees, you know, execs, I don't know, doing whatever it is that they do, imposing or insisting on whatever it is they think they know and all that. But, yeah, I heard that from a number of people as well. And, look, there's a difference between taking dramatic license, you know, and coming up with a scene that perhaps didn't exactly happen in real life, but nonetheless supports either something about the character, or more to the point, a relationship between, you know, two or more characters. That's okay, you know, if it's honest and
right,
you're trying to, you know, get something dramatic or funny or whatever across about that person, so that an audience comes to understand it in the context of a motion picture. I mean, all stories, all motion pictures are constructs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's no, you know, the Keno Eye thing died 40 years ago, okay? You know, his ego, Vertov, and, oh, I'm just an extension of my lens. No, he wasn't, okay, because he had to point it at something.
Right.
So, you know, not to get esoteric, but so taking dramatic license, I think it's all right. But just wholesale making stuff up that didn't happen, because why ever? It doesn't matter. That's not only wrong, it's utterly irresponsible.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see that all the time.
Yeah.
You know, look, if you want to make something that is a chronology, or, you know, that's meant to chronicle, you know, a true story, make a documentary.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
Yep.
But
yeah.
If we're making something that's intended as a narrative piece, then it's almost always necessary to, you know, take life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one thing that I always wondered if this really happened, if you've ever seen the movie The Majestic with Jim Carrey.
Sure.
At the opening of the film, Jim Carrey is the writer of a film, and he's sitting in an office with studio execs, and they are basically totally tearing his story apart and making, you know, suggestions, or really not suggestions, demands, I guess.
Right.
And you know, you wonder, is this really true? Does this type of thing happen? And the more I talk to writers, the more it seems that it really does.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I could give you, you know, 10 examples of that in my career, none the least of which is it wasn't an executive, it was the head of the studio.
Mm-hmm.
At the time when I had sold Radio Flyer, summoned me, as it were, to his estate, and on a large bridge over his koi fish lake. Yes, it was a lake. It was not a pond.
Jeez.
Biggest koi fish I've ever seen in my life. Says to me, I love this script. And he's actually holding a copy of it, meaning Radio Flyer.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, that's terrific. Thank you very much. And he says, you wrote my life. And I said, oh, is that good? You know? And he said, yeah, it's really good. It's really good. And he says, just one thing, all right, just one thing. If you kill the dog, I'm not going to make this movie. Well, have to kill the dog. He says, you didn't hear me. If you kill the dog, I'm not going to make this movie. And I made the mistake. I was very young and sort of new, green. I says, well, you know, don't you see that the dog has to die? Because if the dog doesn't die, then the stakes are not raised at the appropriate time in the story to let the audience know that the kid has got to get away or he's next. And that, well, that was an air show. That went over his head like, you know, like a jet. And he looks at me and screams at the top of his lungs. I'll never forget it. Okay, I'm going to use a four-letter word, so put your finger on the beep machine. He says to me in the loudest possible voice, if you kill this fucking dog, I won't make this movie. And I said, and again, I was very young, very green. I said, cool, don't make the movie.
Oh, geez.
And he stares at me and says, you know what? Let's just talk about this later. Come on. So, and that was it. That was the end of the story. And guess what? The dog didn't die.
He won.
So, okay. I learned my lesson, you know?
Wow. Jeez. So, yeah, it's surprising that you would say that, you know, don't make the movie.
Well, I didn't know nothing from nothing, you know? I had no idea that I would... that I was literally saying, fire me. You know,
right.
It was just too new to know anything about that. And the rest of the experience of making that movie, you know, when Richard Donner directed it, God love him, he was incredibly kind to me and let me, I was there every second on set, pre-production, production, post-production, everything. He was very, very kind. And it was baptism by fire.
Right, yeah.
And I'm very grateful that I had that experience because I got a whole lifetime's worth of learning in a very short time.
Yeah. See, now you can make a movie about that, you know, about a writer.
my friend, that book I've been writing that book for many years. One day I will publish that book.
I can't wait for that one, I'll tell you.
Oh, yeah.
All right, David, I want to finish up with two final questions, taking us away from your writing, your directing, producing, everything else. When you sit back and relax, what do you like to watch on TV? What are your favorite TV shows now and of the past? And what's your favorite movies now and of the past?
Oh, wow, what a story. Well, one, I don't have TV. I gave that up a long time ago. I do have, you know, big flat screen and all that, but mostly... that doesn't even get turned on unless Manny Pacquiao is having a fight, and then I'll watch it. So, you know, so there's that. But I do, let's see, recent television shows. I was a big Lost fan when that was around.
Mm-hmm.
I binge-watched in probably, oh, 3 or 4 days, all of Breaking Bad, and that, my estimation, is the greatest television show ever made.
Yeah.
I'm not the only, obviously, many, many people believe that.
Right.
you know, I'm a fan of the show Vikings. I think that, you know,
mm-hmm.
exceptionally well done. Catherine Winnick's a buddy from a long time ago, so I'm very, very happy to see her have all of that success well-deserved. What was the other? Oh, movies. Oh,
movies.
Yeah, movies. I mean, I have a lot of heartfelt favorites. Whenever I want to sit down, watch a movie, and, I don't know, contemplate my position, you know, among the people of the world and cry my eyes out, I watch Woody Allen's Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can watch anything Woody does. I watched the other night, I had not seen Hugo, and that didn't win the Academy Award shocks me. I think Scorsese is, if not the most brilliant director working now, certainly one of the two or three. Movies that influenced me, Star Wars was a huge, huge influence on me when I was 13, 14 years old. You know, anything John Ford did, The Quiet Man,
yeah.
Anything John Huston did, The Treasure of Sierra Madre, that comes to mind. You know, The Searchers, I mean, just spectacularly well-made, well-wrought motion pictures. Does it hold my interest, number one, and does it move me emotionally? And if it does, great.
Yeah.
That's my measuring stick. And I think it was Hitchcock said it. He says, look, movies are only one thing. I think I'm paraphrasing here. They are emotion button pushing machines. Right. And when somebody invents a machine where you can push a button and feel those emotions, then movies are dead. And I hope that no one ever invents that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Well, David, I thank you so much for taking the time. I really enjoyed listening to your stories, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Well, I appreciate it very much as well. Can I plug something while we're on the on the show here?
Sure.
I mentioned a little bit ago the novel that I wrote from which I generated the screenplay for Radio Flyer. Well, that was a little over 20 years ago, and I never published that novel. Well, just a little while ago, I did publish that novel.
Oh, okay.
The novel is The King of Pacoima. And, I mean, literally just published it a few days ago. And I've already got some reviews on Amazon.com on its page. And they're all 5 stars out of 5 stars. So people seem to like it very much. And there are, you know, a lot of people that over the intervening 20 years have asked me over and over and over again, what happened to Bobby at the end of Radio Flyer? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of debate and conjecture about that for over 2 decades. And those answers were and are in the novel. They were never left unanswered, and that was never my intent. So if anybody wants to take a look at that, they can go, obviously, to Amazon or CreateSpace, and they can search The King of Pacoima, or they can go, I just started a website for my little book publishing company called FlyingWagonBooks.com, and you can get all the information about it there as well, and I hope people do.
Yeah, and we'll put a link on our website so people can just click on it and go right to it.
That'd be great. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing this, David. I appreciate it.
Well, right back at you. I'll come on anytime, and it has been my pleasure and my honor. Thank you very much.
I want to thank David Mickey Evans so much for taking the time to talk to us here at On Screen and Beyond. Great guest. He had a lot of information there, and loved hearing the stories he had to tell. And, of course, great film, The Sandlot. If you have not seen it, be sure to check it out. Watch it with the family. The kids will love it, and you will love it too. And also Radio Flyer, another one. And check out his book too. We got a lot of information there for you. And you go to onscreenandbeyond.com. We'll have the link right there. And that is it. We this week I was on the phone a couple of times with different guests who are going to be coming our way shortly here on Screen and Beyond. So once again, if you have a suggestion, send it to me, because a lot of times I don't think of the same people you're thinking of, and I'm trying to find more people, very, you know, diverse group of people here at On Screen and Beyond. So if you could send it to me at feedback@onscreenandbeyond.com, that would be great. I'll see what I can do about getting that person on. And that's it for now. That's a wrap for this week. Until next week, when we once again take you on screen and beyond, I'm Brian Zemrak. Take care.